All right, welcome back. We're going to start with item number, I turned the wrong page here. Our timed item, 11 o'clock item number nine. Discussing consideration of possible action relating to initial case review for the following complaints and possible consolidation. All right. Okay. All right, so we are going to actually start with a call to the public. I do have a request from the call of Republic, call from the public. Jesse Haggard, did I say that right?
Yes.
If you'd like to move forward, right here. Again, you can make a brief statement. We cannot respond to any statement. This is, we are just listening to your statement. If you have a seat, please. And if you'd like to, for the record, state your name.
Good morning, my name is Jesse Sage Haggard.
And Madam Chair,
yes.
You said that this is time limited.
This is a five, yeah, you have a 5 minute time limit.
I have a bachelor's degree in biology from Arizona State University and a doctorate in naturopathic medicine from Southwest College of Naturopathic Medicine. I come from a long line of healthcare practitioners, including medical doctors, pharmacists, and chiropractors. I worked with John W. Denbor last year, and I have some inconsistent findings that John has communicated to this board that I feel compelled to share today. In the November 20th, 2019 board meeting, John Denbor said, quote, "I do not hold the ABPP diplomat in neuropsychology, but I have completed the Division 40 requirements as a neuropsychologist, and therefore, according to Division 40 and APA, I can call myself a neuropsychologist," quote. However, John Denbor does not meet the National Academy of Neuropsychology Policy and Planning Committee's definition of a neuropsychologist endorsed by the Society for Clinical Neuropsychology Division 40 and published in the Archives of Clinical Neuropsychology, Volume 18, Issue 5, July 2003, pages 551-555. The minimum criteria for a clinical neuropsychologist includes, quote, "the equivalent of 2 full-time years of experience in specialized training, at least 1 of which is at the postdoctoral level, in the study and practice of clinical neuropsychology and related neurosciences. These 2 years include supervision by a clinical neuropsychologist," quote. John's 2019 curriculum vitae reads, quote, "July 2006 to August 2007, the Boston Consortium, Boston BA, Harvard U, Boston U, APA-approved clinical psychology internship experience," quote, and, quote, "September 2007 to January 2009, Barrow Neurological Institute, APPCN, approved postdoctoral fellowship in clinical neuropsychology," quote. However, in the board's public record, there's a letter from Barrow Neurological Institute that reads, quote, "John Denbor, PhD, has not performed in a satisfactory manner during his first year of an intended 2-year postdoctoral residency program in clinical neuropsychology. This is the consensus of 6 neuropsychologists who supervised his work with multiple patients during the time frame of September 2007 through August 2008. Quote, "No other postdoctoral fellowship or residency is listed. Since John Denbor did not complete his postdoctoral residency in a satisfactory manner, I think it is an issue of public safety for him to represent himself as a neuropsychologist, which I will provide specific reasons why." At the same board meeting, John Denbor said the following statements, quote, "In no way in any paper or any document have I ever said this is a dementia prevention program. Nothing prevents dementia. Nothing we have prevents dementia in any way, unfortunately, and I would never ever state that anyone verbally, quite frankly, I resent the implication that I would state that." John publicly says his SMART program can prevent dementia repeatedly. In a video on YouTube entitled, "How to Treat Dementia with SMART Brain Aging," John says, quote, Dementia is a disease that can be preventable. Quote, one way of doing this is through a system of new and novel brain exercises. Quote, quote, I have developed such a system. It is called SMART. Quote. Also at the same board meeting, when asked, could you address the issue of a six-week program and you have patients or individuals going way beyond that? Quote, John said, quote, that's entirely inaccurate. In SMART Memory Program Version A, which I have here, on page 8, it reads, six-week program, quote, page 8. At the same board meeting, John said, quote, Blue Cross Blue Shield alleged that there was not only documentation provided because when they made the request for my office, only 55% of the records were indeed provided. In fact, 98% of the records were provided upon re-request to Blue Cross Blue Shield. Quote, Blue Cross Blue Shield of Arizona Advantage has conducted and reported two audits of John Denmore in 2019. The combined audits requested a total of 297 client records requests. John and his staff provided a total of 51 client records to Blue Cross Blue Shield Advantage, resulting in a 17.2% fulfillment of the requested records, not originally 55% or 98% on resummission like he told the board.
Sir, you have 30 seconds.
After review of his submitted records, Blue Cross Blue Shield Advantage determined a, quote, 100% error rate, quote, for numerous reasons requesting a refund of $47,000. $47,016.49. There's a pattern here. And that's all.
Thank you. Thank you for your comments and for being here today. I want to now move on to item complaint number 1826. We have an expert witness on the phone. Dr. Lichtenberg? Lichtenberg, are you there? All right. I'm going to have Dr. Flowers. Can you provide a brief summary? Because I know we only have Dr. Lichtenberg until about 12.
That's right. Yeah.
I think we're all pretty familiar with the cases. If you could provide a summary, I think it's 26, and is it 042 that Dr. Lichtenberg is?
That is correct.
So Dr. Lichtenberg is an expert witness, and he's going to be addressing item number 1826 and item 1904. Dr. Flowers, you can provide a brief overview.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. I will do my best. It won't be totally brief, but I'll go ahead and...
I'm having trouble hearing.
Oh, okay. You want the expert witness first?
No, I need to do a summary.
Okay, sure. The complaint is from ET of Blue Cross. It says that Dr. Dunbar presents his smart brain aging program at assisted living facilities. And he says it's free or covered under insurance. ET stated that he bills his smart neuropsychology services under his private practice. He signs some individuals up for the smart program who have no history of cognitive dysfunction. Once the individual is signed up for the program, they do not see Dr. Dunbar again until he makes another presentation of the facility, which is approximately every 6 weeks. And then somebody from the SMART program staff goes to the facility once or twice a week to facilitate activities and one-on-one activities. Another member said that they had one-on-one sessions with Dr. Dunbar. He billed neuropsychology codes to Medicaid several times a month for the same individuals, and there was no documentation to support his billing. He signs the notes, but the members denied having any services provided by Dr. Dunbar. And review of other professionals' records do not support Dr. Denbar's diagnosis of some members. Blue Cross alleges that it appears the documentation offered by Dr. Dunbar seems to be skewed to support his research program. And also they stated that testing performed contradicts the results in Dr. Dunbar's reports. The Complaint Screening Committee held on July 17th, 2019 audio recording was reviewed by ET, and at time 1:19:54 of the recording, Dr. Dunbar stated to the Complaint Screening Committee that he renders a low volume of psychotherapy services to patients, but in the plans analysis, it was determined that Dr. Dunbar may personally render a low volume of these services but the billing to the plan indicates that psychotherapy services was billed under NPI 1,015 times for their members from 2016 to 2019. And the documentation and data review also showed that unqualified staff with no credentials identified or licensed in speech pathology were providing these services to the members. Basically, it could be a speech pathologist or other people. In the summary of ET's report, it said that they conducted medical chart audits in 2018 and 19. There were 57 medical records received, and of the 36 requested for review, the following findings were identified: services that were not medically necessary, unqualified personnel rendering services, documentation not supporting the services billed, signatures for the rendering provider were either missing or did not meet standards, no time documented in the standard medical record to support time-based codes to the plan, medical records submitted to the board. Let's see. There were some medical records that were simply not submitted, and the provider's contract was recommended for termination from the network. And due to the findings of the two sample audits, a refund check of $47,016.49 was requested within 15 days of receipt of the findings. And the licensee basically said that he provides information regarding the SMART program. He did that from 2014 to 2017. He'd go to assisted living facilities and present information. Interested people were signed up, and then he would offer neuropsychological evaluations to individuals, and he would give them their cognitive functioning diagnoses and recommendations for potential treatment. Individuals who wanted to participate were required to sign the informed consent, and then they would also authorize Dr. Denbar to bill Medicare. The interested individuals were scheduled for neuropsyche bowels that consisted of interview and evaluative tests. Once the testing was done, it provided recommendations to the individuals, and they might include SMART programs or other activities. He said he is working with Blue Cross to solve the issues, and he said also that he was implementing new policies, procedures, and practices since before he started the consent agreement, and he requested that the complaint be dismissed as his current consent agreement and order addresses the same issues. On the 17th of July of this of last year, the case went to the complaint screening committee, and the committee voted to send the case for review for possible violations of ARS 32-2061, 16A, for possibly obtaining a fee by fraud or misrepresentation, C, for possibly making or using statements of a character tending to deceive or mislead, E, for possible gross negligence in the practice of psychologists, H, for possibly failing or refusing to maintain adequate business, financial, or professional records. O, for possibly providing services that are unnecessary and unsafe, or otherwise engaging in activities as a psychologist that are unprofessional by current standards. And ARS 16DD, for possibly violating an ethical standard adopted by the board as it pertains to Section 6.04, financial and fee arrangements of the APA, ethical principles of psychologists and code of conduct. This completes my overview of the case.
Thank you, Dr. Flowers. Dr. Lichtenberg, you are on the line.
Madam Chair, if I may interrupt.
Yes.
I do just want to let you know that yesterday, Dr. Lichtenberg did email me some information regarding his professional background and experience. I'm just going to pass this information out.
All right, thank you. Dr. Lichtenberg.
I'm sorry, you're breaking up on me. I'm getting an echo.
Sorry, we can hear you well. Could you provide a summary like you did at the CSC meeting in regards to your findings of your review of the case?
Sure. I thought I would also just provide a brief overview of my background.
Thank you.
In his opening remarks, the last time I provided input to a subgroup of the board, Dr. Denbo's attorney insinuated perhaps I was involved in this matter because of professional jealousy. I thought it might be useful just for me to give a brief overview of my career, one that has been dedicated to work with older adults and their families. I completed my PhD in clinical psychology at Purdue University with a minor in aging. I finished the geropsychology focused internship at the Gainesville, Florida VA, and completed a postdoctoral fellowship in geriatric neuropsychology at the University of Virginia with Dr. Jeffrey Barth. In my 33-year career, I've worked as a clinician, a researcher, a program and department director, and for the last 20 years, a director of the Institute of Gerontology at Wayne State University, as well as a professor of psychology. I earned a diplomate in both rehabilitation psychology and geropsychology. Dementia and cognitive assessment of older adults has been a major part of the work I do throughout my career, having assessed well over 2,500 older adults for cognitive decline in dementia and neurocognitive functioning is a focus of many of my over 200 peer-reviewed publications and book chapters and 7 authored or edited books. For the American Psychological Association, I was senior editor for its first handbook in clinical geropsychology, published in 2015. I have a thriving psycholegal consulting practice in the area of older adult financial capacity and financial exploitation. Working to enhance the lives of older adults is what energizes and inspires me. In sum, I'm one of the most satisfied psychologists in the profession. This is the first time I have ever reviewed another psychologist's work on behalf of a board of psychology. Gives me no pleasure whatsoever to do so, but I agreed to do it because of the need for all of us to be vigilant in protecting older adults. Now to my summary. I reviewed 12 files. I was supplied much of the notes, testing notes, and billing practices. I took extensive notes on each file, and the thing that I provided was an overall summary, a case-by-case summary, and my handwritten notes, as well as a 2017 Lancet review article on dementia. I included that because of the importance of understanding while there have been epidemiological studies relating cognitive activity and stimulation to lower dementia rates. Experimental design does not proven that we have yet the ability to delay or prevent dementia. Overall, there were 9 issues that came up, and I want to talk about the most important ones. First is, it's clear that this was presented as a dementia prevention program. In case AB, in case AF for the consent form, it says smart aging, help prevent dementia. That was the headline of the note. So, you know, the message is clear there. And then in case AB, there's specific notes from the speech-language pathologist. Patients benefiting from regular SMART sessions with a speech and language therapist for prevention. Another note that this is someone who has agreed to do the SMART program on a preventative basis. Those are, of course, very concerning, depending on how this program has been portrayed. And the thing that I saw gave me great concern that it's being presented as a dementia prevention program. There are several abstracts that Dr. Denbauer has published for the Alzheimer's meetings. the contents of which are mostly the same across the years, but I'll read this Wednesday, July 17, 2019, abstract, which says, result, an average improvement 4.25 were MOCA points at the conclusion of this six-week program. Although this improvement was seen as temporary in nature. In other words, each of the reports indicates that there is improvement, but that improvement goes away once the program is stopped. The neuropsychological reports that I reviewed were wholly inadequate. They did not discuss the medical, functional, or collateral report information, and thus had a lack of history of cognitive function and lacked the ability to meaningfully integrate the test results with the person's overall condition. Dementia is defined precisely as a decline in function, decline in cognitive function that impacts everyday life of an individual. And without those functional elements, such as things like driving, medication usage, financial management, social engagement, without any sense of those things, it's really not possible to not only diagnose dementia, but to meaningfully use neuropsychological test results to help the person in coping with their situation. In almost every case that I reviewed, there was excessive neuropsychological testing. Dr. Denbauer, in the previous hearing with the subcommittee, demonstrated that he knew extremely well how factor in practice effects, but I did not see any evidence of that in the reports that I reviewed. And so it's very, very difficult to make any conclusions from these overly frequent testing. In one case, somebody was tested, I believe, a dozen times within a single year. Each of those testings came with a separate neuropsychological consultation session. Each of those reports was almost identical to the one before in its conclusions, even when the data said normative cognitive data, if there had been a mild impairment on the first testing, the mild cognitive impairment diagnosis remained. So, the test results seemed like they really were not used on behalf of the patients. There was a failure in the notes to change or adapt treatment based on test results. And so, again, these seem to be testing for billing purposes, not so much for the individual patient's benefit. So on 110-19, for example, on case DC, talks about she's currently being seen for diagnosis of normative cognitive function. Recommendation, continue with SMART program. Have no idea what that might mean. The SMART program may well be a very useful thing for helping people improve certain skills, but as far as a medically necessary treatment for somebody with normative cognitive function, I don't think it would meet that standard. Dr. Denbauer described his biller's knowledge of Medicare. I'm no longer a Medicare provider. I used to be. I have not been for some time. But I did know that his testing score and report writing, as per his own records, was no more than 2 hours. But when his technicians were billing, they indicated that scoring alone took 3.5 to 4 hours. And this seemed not at all possible or proper. So in sum, Dr. Denbauer seemed to be promoting a service that wasn't supported by the evidence to older adults who in many cases did not need medically necessary any extra cognitive training. His assessment did not include standard practice such as integration with medical problems, functional abilities, and history. His reports referred patients for unnecessary and costly services. And that concludes my summary.
Thank you so much, Doctor. Board members, do you have any questions for Dr. Lichtenberg?
Yes, Doctor, you reviewed 12 cases?
I reviewed 12 cases.
In all cases?
I provided those to you.
In all cases, you found difficulties?
I would say, I believe there might have been one or two in which essentially the person dropped out of treatment fairly quickly.
How would you describe the quality of the work you reviewed?
Extremely poor. I would not even describe the reports as graduate level work. When I talk about integrating with a person's function and history, I'm not just talking about medications. I'm talking about their life and kind of how they perceive their own cognitive abilities, how others perceive their cognitive abilities, what they've noticed in terms of changes and function. This is very serious and very important in the case of dementia to get an accurate early diagnosis. It has a lot of implications for many things.
Absolutely.
I can see that in these cases.
So the quality of work, so I get this straight, the quality of work you reviewed was less than a graduate level report would be?
Yes.
You found the testing to be inadequate?
I found the testing to be, the test reports particularly, to be inadequate. I found the repeat testing and the interpretation to be inadequate as well.
And you were concerned about excessive amounts of time and billing?
Yes.
And that was specifically in scoring and report preparation?
Yes. Specifically when he changed, when the records were, that his technicians were billing, they were taking 3.5 to 4 hours for score and test results.
Was there any indication in the patient record of supervision of the technicians or staffing with the technician?
There was no indication or discussion of that, of any of that in the record that I reviewed.
Thank you, Doctor.
Dr. Flowers.
Yes, I wanted to also ask, I reviewed a lot of the records as well, but I congratulate you on your detail and scrutiny and being very, very thorough. One thing that I want to see if you saw this as well, typically there's no summary of the individual's medical background. If anything, it just says, if you want to look at it, look in the medical record yourself. Well, he doesn't say it like that. It just says they're available if you want to look at them. But I didn't really see that relevant things were highlighted to justify diagnoses. Is that essentially what you were saying as well?
I'm sorry, if that was a question for me, I was losing parts of it, and you were...
Okay, I tend to ramble.
No, it's a matter of hearing.
Okay. Frequently...
The sound is not...
Okay, in records, sometimes it just says, in regards to the previous medical records, they're available, but it doesn't really summarize anything about what's in the records that is relevant to the case. Did you see that as well?
I did, absolutely. That's part of what I mean by there's no mention of medical or functional history or everyday activities, correct?
Okay, and also, was there clarity in regards to who actually did the testing and interviewing, whether it was Dr. Denbaugh or staff?
Was there clarity about what? I'm sorry.
I understand that he had some technicians assist with testing.
Yes.
Were you able to figure out who did what within the reports?
In the cases of the technicians, it seemed clear that they had done the testing for those cases and scored. He always was the one who did, quote, the neuropsychological consultation session, which really didn't illuminate what he talked to these clients about at all.
Okay, and also wondered if you saw mental status examinations that you thought were adequate.
Yes, the testing users are fine, but when you use them as many times as, I'm looking at AB right now, case AB. This is page 6 of 16 of my report summary. And you see 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 testings across a little bit more than a year, every 2 months, essentially. There's no, in none of the reports does it discuss practice corrections for practice effects.
Okay, another issue. Oh, go ahead.
And in none of the reports does it refer this person for further services for diagnostic evaluation or medical interventions.
Okay, did you see like clinical histories within the
no.
film? Okay. Because frequently when you talk with a client, you get a history of the problem. Did you, didn't see that either then?
No, that was not present.
Okay.
And it's critical for dementia assessment.
Okay, thank you.
Are there any further questions from the board? No, hearing none. Dr. Lichtenberg, thank you so much for joining us today. You're welcome to stay on the line, or I know you've had another engagement.
I will stay on until close to two.
Okay, thank you. All right. Dr. Denberg, are you, your president, would you like to move forward?
And just for the record, the complainant is not present for 1826.
Okay, thank you.
Can we have one more question?
No, Dr. Des, we're taking case 1826. That's the one that Dr. Lichtenberg reviewed, as well as 1904, but we can build that one at that point. Welcome. Thank you for being here. If you could introduce yourselves for the record, I'd appreciate that.
Absolutely. Good morning. Still good morning. And Happy New Year to everybody. My name is Artie Eves, and I'm here with Dr. John Denbaugh.
John Denbaugh.
Thank you for being here. Would you like to make any opening comments?
Yes, thank you. In going through this process with Dr. Denbaugh, I can tell you that I've never worked with a client who has taken the process more seriously and invested more time and more of himself into the process of improvement. I've also never had a case where I've seen such vast disagreement among experts about someone's work. I did want to take a moment while Dr. Lichtenberg is on the phone to apologize if I in any way implied that his involvement in this case was due to some professional jealousy. That was certainly not my intent. I do not question his integrity in his involvement in this case. What I was referring to was some of the intent of some of the complainants who had filed complaints here, and perhaps he didn't understand the context of that. So I'd like to apologize to him for leaving that implication. I do question, though, have experts who have such widely varying opinions. This board looked into some complaints regarding Dr. Denbor and appointed a practice monitor that the board chose, the board felt was qualified to look into his practice. That's Dr. Toma. Dr. Toma's here today, seated behind us, and I'm sure that this board will have an opportunity to talk to him today. Dr. Toma feels that Dr. Denbor's reporting is satisfactory and it meets the standard of care. He's written glowing reports about Dr. Denbor to this board, and I know you know that. He has looked at Dr. Denbor's billing practices. He has walked through the billing practices for the Smart Grid Aging System with John. If you ask him today what he thinks about that, he'll tell you he thinks that he's billing appropriately. So we have right there, between Dr. Lichtenberg and Dr. Toma, we have widely varying opinions from experts, both of whom you hired. These aren't even my experts or John's experts. These are experts that this board hired. And the kinds of allegations that are being thrown around at this point, when I hear experts saying things like fraud and things like that, when we have a situation where there's a huge difference of opinion in the validity of this program and in the way that it's being approached, the way that the reports are being written, and the way that it's being billed. But gosh, in my mind and in the law, fraud requires knowing and intentional conduct. And when you've got experts who have such widely varying opinions, both experts that this board hired, I don't think you can find any evidence, certainly not clear and convincing, that there's any kind of fraud going on. I'm sure this board is going to have specific questions for Dr. Denbor, and he's prepared to answer those. And I want to let him do that. I'm not a psychologist, as you all know. And when I try to act like one, I get myself in trouble here. So I'm not going to do that. But I, you know, I've been doing this a long time. And I'm telling you, this guy has put tens of thousands of dollars into this. In addition to the practice monitoring and everything he's done, he has hired independent experts himself to come in and audit his practice, to fly in from out of state. These are professionals who do this for a living to help him do what he's doing right. That was after he finished the practice monitoring with Dr. Toma. And we've worked with several other experts. You know, depending on what the outcome is here today, I am working with other experts you're going to hear from in this case. And they're going to tell you that they've reviewed what John's done. They've reviewed the same materials that Dr. Lichtenberg has, and they disagree with him vastly. And they disagree with him when it comes to billing, when it comes to report writing. I'm not unaware that there are many on here who are qualified to have their own opinions about John's work, and I suspect that those opinions vary somewhat as well. So you've got a tough job ahead of you here. But the one thing I would say is the person that you appointed to evaluate John's practice, to audit John's practice, and to see what he did, that person is telling you this is a valuable member of your community. This is somebody who needs to keep practicing in Arizona. This is somebody who brings value to the practice of psychology in Arizona. And I encourage you to ask Dr. Toma about that today and to ask him about his disagreements with Dr. Lichtenberg and to ask him how sincere John is about his love for the job that he does and the help that he does for the elderly population. Now, I appreciate the accommodation on time here. I need to tell you that John is, this has taken a toll on John. And I know that's part of the process. It happens. We see it with these complaints. And I know this board does not relish what happens sometimes to people who are going through this process. So I'm in no way blaming anyone here for that. But you need to know, his practice is shut down. John is no longer practicing. The Smart Brain Aging company has been stopped. It's not going on. This has taken a financial toll on John that is almost unbelievable. I'm not going to share those numbers publicly, but I can tell you it's staggering. It's taken an emotional toll on him. Whatever process this is has got to stop. And I'm not saying that the board has done anything wrong. I'm pleading with you to please, let's get this thing headed in the direction of a resolution. We've been going through this for such a long time. I would just ask this board to please expedite whatever agreement we're going to enter into. John is happy to cooperate. He has been enthusiastic in his cooperation with this board. he'll do whatever he needs to do to continue to practice and practice at the level that he needs to. So again, thank you for the indulgence.
Thank you. Mr. Denver, do you have any comments or?
Yeah.
I would say that I have a variety of comments, and those comments are perhaps somewhat wide-ranging. I won't address the points that Mr. Eads did, except to say that what he said is accurate. There's a larger context to this quote-unquote story, and that will be heard, hopefully, in future proceedings with this board. But the statement that you just heard from Mr. Haggard is one that's very exemplative of how I feel this sort of interaction has become with this board, of no fault of this board's at all. You heard from an individual about various statements that I may or may not have made, that in his statements may have been accurate or not accurate, only the evidence will tell. But I do want to have you know that what you, in 2009, while I finished my first year at Barrow and had to leave there because my brother, who has schizophrenia, needed help, Mr. Haggard was convicted on running a steroid ring as a naturopathic physician. And he was involved in money laundering and stripped of his license by the Arizona Naturopathic Board. So when people come up here, and of course they're allowed to speak in manners that are slanderous and defamatory towards me, I would simply encourage the board to seek evidence of this and look at these sort of indications and statements from a wider context. And I'm happy to provide that evidence, or I'm sure you can look at that yourself. My company, just to sort of briefly state, my company was involved in a fraudulent takeover by an investor who is friends with Mr. Haggard. That's why Mr. Haggard has been present at many of the past board meetings, sitting directly behind Mr. Eves and I and Dr. Toma. Mr. Haggard has broken into our house. He's threatened my wife. And we have an order of protection against Mr. Haggard. So there's a larger context as to what has happened here. I don't want to sort of get off onto that tangent, but I did want to assert that. I also want to simply assert that I respect Dr. Lichtenberg's opinion highly. He's obviously a well-respected member of this community. But when I hear terms like fraud being tossed around, I do want to humbly state that I started this program and I got into geriatric neuropsychology because I was raised by my grandmother. My grandmother developed dementia later in her life. And I lived with her for a long period of time. And the loss of her before she physically died is the most galvanized experience that I ever had. I made between $30,000 and $40,000 a year in the last 4 to 5 years, and I spent over $350,000 of my personal money, my family's money, and my extended family's money to develop this program that was approved by Medicare to do and to run this business. And that business is now over. But to suggest in any way that I was involved in some sort of scheme of scheming older people out of money or providing medically unnecessary services is absolutely false. Medicare themselves has deemed these services medically necessary. Medicare has. I got this program. I didn't start this program on my own. This is a model and a template program that is conducted at 15 major centers throughout the United States. And I've said that in previous board proceedings, and I'll say it again. This is the exact model, the exact thing I do is being conducted at 15 geriatric neuropsychology centers throughout the United States. This program was approved through the Center for Innovation Systems at Medicare, and it took 2 to 3 years to get this approved. And it took randomized clinical trials, double-blind randomized clinical trials, that were conducted to get this approved. This is not something that I hung up a shingle and started, and it's not something that I'm doing any different than any other centers at UPenn, UCLA, Harvard, Emory, et cetera. Now, Dr. Lichtenberg is not aware of that, and I would respectfully say, if you're not in that clinical circle of experts in the area of mild cognitive impairment and domestic mild cognitive impairment and early stage dementia mitigation, of which there is about 30 people in the United States that are experts in this area, then you would not know. Dr. Lichtenberg is not an expert in this area in any way. And some of his statements, quite frankly, indicate that. So Dr. Tolmaum, who's a neuropsychologist, reviewed my work. And I have, right now, four experts in the area of geriatric neuropsychology that are ABAP, Diplomat Geriatric Neuropsychologists, that are aware of this program, including Tony Puente, who, as many of you are aware, is the expert in building and coding, and wrote the books on building and coding. Tony Puente wrote me a letter approving this program before I implemented it. I correspond with Tony Puente regularly regarding this program, regarding the building, expertise, etc. Tony Puente is the president of the National Academy of Neuropsychology. Tony Puente views me as a neuropsychologist. I was approved to sit before the ABET board to take the test. So when you hear statements saying that I don't meet the Division 40 requirements, Division 40 said I met the requirements. Division 40 themselves said it. They put it in writing. So those statements are slanderous, defamatory, and they are entirely incorrect. I never in any way billed incorrectly for any patient. And there's, quite frankly, there's a variety of information here that's entirely inaccurate. And just, quite frankly, instead of, and I'm not faulting the board, instead of having me come up here and say, this is what John Denmore believes, or then Dr. Lichtenberg says, this is what I believe, or Dr. Thomas says, this is what I believe, let's just go to the evidence. How many times have I been audited by Medicare? How many times have I gotten 100% clean audits by Medicare? What is the approval of the program through Medicare that says explicitly in writing that the services are medically necessary? I mean, I'm sure the board is somewhat frustrated or tired of hearing my opinion or my statements. I think we should just go right to the evidence.
Thank you. Thank you for those comments. Questions from the board members? Dr. Flowers.
Yes, I'm wondering too, looking at through some of the records, there are some where the diagnosis is normal or normative cognitive functioning, and then you recommend the program for potential mitigation of migration or, you know, difficulties related to dementia and speech therapy, and then to come back in 8 weeks or 6 weeks for an additional set of tests to see how the person is doing. If somebody checks out to have normal cognitive aging, how can you clinically justify a round of treatment and billing anybody for that?
So thank you for the question. With all due respect, I believe this is a question and an issue that's been raised multiple times in the past when I've been in front of this board, and I've answered it repeatedly.
Let me just bring our information. We do have some new board members.
Okay.
So
sure.
Dr. Gill is new, and so I want to, and he is a member of this board and part of this discussion. So it may feel like we're repeating, but if you wouldn't mind addressing it.
Again, and just to be fair, Dr. Flowers, I'm very happy to answer it. This is actually something I really am passionate about. So let me just use an analogy real briefly. Cardiologists don't just treat heart attacks, heart disease after you have a heart attack. Does that make sense? So like the model in terms of mild cognitive impairment in MSing mild cognitive impairment in the last 10 to 15 years, primarily emanating out of Stanford Longevity Center and the UCLA Center under Gary Small and other neuropsychologists, and then Glenn Smith, who was at Mayo, now at University of Florida. It very clearly looks at very early identification of individuals as they are aging in hopes that we can stem decline, cognitive and functional decline, at their earliest of ages. So the way the current state-of-the-art practices, and it's deemed medically necessary by Medicare, quite frankly, because myself and other colleagues went to the Center for Innovation Systems in 2003 to 2006 and conducted the research to support that, states that what we want to do is keep the brain engaged in new and novel activity. And in doing so, what that does is that the research has shown that it helps offset the onset of something called mild cognitive impairment. So mild cognitive impairment is the clinical precursor to dementia. It's shown to develop 10 to 15 years prior to the onset of dementia. So when we talk about dementia, quote-unquote, treatment, what we're talking about is the early identification of mild cognitive impairment. So what they're doing at UCLA, or what they're doing at UPenn, or what they're doing at Harvard right now, and Stanford, is they are taking normal aging individuals that are 55, 60 years old, and they're putting them through Medicare reimbursable, commercial insurance reimbursable, speech and language therapy, and occupational therapy once weekly for long periods of time. And they're using the exact same testing model that I'm using, every 8-week testing. Like I said to this board before, I never came up with this on my own. This came out of my training, and this is something that I'm using that's consistent with many other research facilities, but also many other clinical facilities, and they're billing in the same exact way that I'm billing. So in short answer to your question, Dr. Flowers, if we don't start getting people to do activity when they reach their 55, 60, 65 years old, we have very little chance at even mitigating onset of Alzheimer's and other types of dementia when people reach their 80s, because it's a 20 to 25 year silent process prior to that. Does that answer your question?
It kind of does. Okay. That means that a lot of folks here on the board could be involved right now, even though we're doing fine. And I really doubt that my medical plan would cover that.
If you have Medicare, it will.
Okay, I'm not on the insurance boards. I don't know all the rules, but it just, to me, it seemed like some kind of pathology needs to be present and treated.
It did.
Otherwise, it'd be like a wellness program.
It did prior to us going to the Center for Innovation Systems and getting it approved under no diagnosis of dementia. And that's why when Medicare audits me and all these other labs, the audits are entirely clean and entirely 100%. And I presented to this board approximately a 70-page document that went through every single Medicare jurisdiction in the United States and showed that it was approved in every single Medicare jurisdiction.
So he asked you about the serial testing that you do, which is, I know from sitting through these meetings, that's a little bit different than the kind of maybe annual testing that's done in traditional neuropsychology where you're following a patient. So could you address that a little bit?
Yes, I mean, serial testing model is something that's really, I think there's some rehab psychologists on this board. They have familiarity with serial neuropsychological testing during rehab, like traumatic brain injury improvement or stroke improvement, et cetera. That model was adapted about 20 to 25 years ago to help do serial testing for individuals with mild cognitive impairment and MSing mild cognitive impairment and even normative aging. So the standard right now, and again, I'm not trying to dismiss Dr. Lichtenberg or degrade him in any way, but it's apparent that he is not knowledgeable about what is considered gold standard in MSing mild cognitive impairment and mild cognitive impairment. So the serial testing is considered gold standard.
Okay, there's some other cases too, but those are my main ones.
Glenn's case.
within a, I'm just going to ask simple questions, because you're right in your statements that we just need to get to the facts, because there's too much opinion floating around. Is the treatment you provide in the National Registry of Evidence-Based Programs and Practices? Is it NREPT?
You know what, honestly, I don't know. I think the answer to that may be no, but I don't know.
That's a two-year process to get approved, and if you're in it, you know it because of the Langley process it goes through.
Yeah, can I just make just one quick statement, Dr. Francie? I just want to, I appreciate your statements. I just want to slightly correct you and say this, what I'm providing, again, just as a reminder, is not any different than what many other people are, many other places are providing. It's the same exact thing.
I don't doubt that. I'm again, just looking at the facts, please. I have seen and heard multiple times here that you have an unclean audit from Blue Cross Blue Shield, where they came in and said, I don't know what the hell they said. They came in and said, you owe us $47,000 and change back again for the services that were not medically necessary. Is that a true fact?
That's my understanding, but the sort of this, I have not been given access to those records, so that is my understanding.
I'm just trying to get the facts. The facts are that part of this business dispute that Dr. Denmore has been engaged in, which has been horrible, has resulted in him being locked out of his practice. And although he has requested the results of that audit letter a number of times from his former partners, they refuse to provide it to him. Refuse to provide him even with the information as to whether or not a check has been cut or is being disputed. So unfortunately, I'd love to get the bottom of the facts to that too.
Then let me, I'm not an attorney, so if I struggle with a question, that's because I'm not an attorney. I'm just a regular old psychologist. There was a large chunk of your services provided to individuals covered by Blue Cross and Blue Shield that were found to be not medically necessary. I don't know how many or what the dollar amount is, but on that audit, which I have heard of different numbers of charts that were audited or maybe not available to be audited, but there was a finding against you for unnecessary, medically unnecessary services. Is that a fair factual statement?
That is, yes, I believe that's accurate.
I understand the details, we don't know all the details, and they're in dispute, and they're being reviewed, and they're being yada, 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 yada. I got that. The program that you run is, and you have manuals for, and those manuals are used in a dozen other facilities or centers? Is that accurate?
No, that's a great question. The manuals we've adapted for ourselves. It came out of research that had been done at Harvard, and VA Boston, but the use of speech and language pathologists to perform cognitive activity, that is being used at multiple other centers.
We were using OTPG speech as a rehabilitation team at Good Sam 35 years ago. That's been around for a long time.
Well, I would just say with older people.
Exactly. If you're on a head injury unit, you also have the unit is going to be strokes. The majority of stroke patients are elderly. So that, yes, I certainly agree that's there. I'd also like to clear up this other thing, because I've heard the rumors and I've heard stories, and I agree with you, I want the facts. Did you complete a two-year postdoctoral residency in the Barrows Neuropsych program?
I did not complete 2 years.
Okay. And
you've left for family reasons or medical reasons or whatever reasons, it's been suggested they were performance-based reasons. Is that accurate?
Well, it is not, and I would like to remind the board that this was actually adjudicated in front of the board when I first got my license. The board at that time.
I'm just asking for the fact from you right now, not what the board did before or what happened.
No, there was not. I had a disagreement with Dr. Bergantano, and it was found, I don't want to say it without referencing that. I had average to above average ratings by everybody else up until Dr. Bergantano. I had a disagreement with him. Larry Cohen brought that in front of this board, presented the actual documentation regarding my evaluations, and I believe this board determined that it was not performance-based.
Okay. Thank you. Tough areas to talk about, but I want to talk about. You've been accepted by ABEP to take the test in neuropsych?
Yes, sir.
And when were you accepted as a candidate for the ABEP testing in neuropsych?
I think it was approximately like 2012.
And I know they only keep those files open for X number of months.
Correct.
You have not taken the test.
Yeah, I have no excuse. I simply got busy and didn't do it.
Okay. I'll stop there. Let other folks have a crack.
That indicates that you're not board certified at this point?
Yes, sir.
And you're not certified as a neuropsychologist?
I would disagree with that. There's no certification as a neuropsychologist.
Well, there's board certification?
Well, no, I'm sorry. What I was going to say is there's no certification beyond board certification.
I noticed in one of your reports, you had a, you described yourself as, was it a neurophysiologist? Correct me. Well, I think it's in one of your neuropsychological reports at the top. I think it said neurophysiology or neurophysiologist.
I would.
So I took that to mean that you were presenting yourself as a neurophysiologist, if I have the wording correct.
I might respectfully say I've never referred to myself in any context in my entire life as a neurophysiologist. If that was in any report, that was a complete and utter error, but I respectfully state that I don't think I made that error. Could you possibly present that to me?
I have to look it up in the paperwork. I don't know where it is, but I'll look it up when I have a chance. I noticed in that same report that you had written a brief neuropsychological report that took 8 hours. And when I read that, I thought, in all my practice, I've never seen a brief neuropsychological report lasting 8 hours.
I'm not an attorney here, but I've been to enough board meetings that might just respectfully state something. I really can't respond to something that I'm not looking at. I think it's only fair to, if you're alleging something, to present with what you're...
Are your brief neuropsychological reports, do they last 8 hours?
No, sir.
How long do they last?
I typically do I bill for about five total units. So it might be 3 units of 96119 and 1 unit of 90791 and 1 unit of 96118.
Dr. Hill, if I might, I don't think that John's trying to be rebellious or in any way resist answering your question. But as the attorney here, I can tell you what he's referring to is there have literally been thousands and thousands of pages of records that we've submitted to this board. And one of the things that we have raised with the board's attorney is that it's difficult, even I think maybe a due process issue, that we come into these meetings and we've submitted thousands of pages of documentation, and we don't have any notice about what's going to be asked out of those thousands. And I'm not criticizing you at all, sir. I just am trying to orient you to the issue.
My apologies. I should have had it in front of me.
Any further questions? Dr. Flowers?
Yes, I'm wondering too, there are times where it's not clear who did what. I guess frequently the neuropsych people, technicians do the testing. And I'm not clear, you told in a previous meeting how they're trained, but they're not licensed, as I recall. You just do your own informal training with them, and then when you feel that they're trained enough, they go to work?
I would say that that's a generally fair statement. I would just perhaps educate the board that this is very common. This is standard of practice in neuropsychology. So I'm guessing Dr. Bohansky may correct me, but I'm guessing there's between 20 and 30 neuropsychologists in Phoenix Metro. And I would suggest that 90% use neuropsychology technicians. And I would also suggest that they are trained. I'm not aware of a license for a neuropsychology. There's credentialing, but there's not licensing. And I train them the same way that I was trained as a neuropsychology technician over a 6-month process of seeing administration, practicing administration, then doing administration on a not a patient, and then doing administration with me, and then eventually doing it with a patient under supervision. There's been articles written about this, and I follow the standards that have been written about this.
We talked about this before, and I know there are new people here, so I just want to...
Well, yeah, that's part of the rationale. I just want to...
Right, and I wanted to open up the discussion a little bit more to say, the last time we talked about this, there was a robust discussion, and I think someone joked that you might have volunteered to open up the new neuropsych tech licensing program, but there's not one. And the point is that it's sort of a community-based standard. They are in use in the community.
Okay.
There's not a regulation. There's not a chapter of ARS that governs their use or their practice. So I think that the answer is it's a community-based standard that has to be determined by the people who are practicing in the community.
Okay. What about occasions where... Have there been times, though, when the neuropsych technicians do the interviewing and testing and you don't meet with the client and then a report is generated?
I believe that the only instance where that ever occurred, to my recollection, I'm not going to say my entire career, but in the time that I've been in Arizona, which has been about 11 years, has been actually a complaint that was brought before this board.
Yeah.
And that was my, that is something due to this complaint that I will never do again.
So that was kind of a fluke rather than a common practice?
It was a fluke, and it was, I wouldn't call it a, I would say this. I have asked 5 experts and local neuropsychologists whether that was an acceptable practice, and they said it was, and they will submit in writing that was an acceptable practice. So if I would call it a mistake on my part, I would say that I regret doing it because it resulted in a board complaint.
I think John is understandably a little bit defensive about questions. What happened in the particular case you're asking about, Dr. Flowers, is that an evaluee made an appointment. John became extremely ill. John asked the evaluee to reschedule the appointment. The evaluee demanded to be seen. And John, is being unable to come into the office, opted to have his tech perform the testing. John did all of the interpretation of the testing himself, called that evaluee, and had a follow-up session and discussed the results. So that's an outlier for his practice, and it was an extreme situation. I don't think that it's necessary to go into what
people he's talking
about.
Thank you.
Dr. Gill?
I'd like to follow up on a question I asked before, and I know this is one report, so perhaps it sounds a little unfair, but I still am curious. The report you wrote was a brief neuropsychological assessment in, I believe it's
November 13th of 2015.
Dr. Gale, can you give us the page number? You're on, and we're on case, you're on the right, case 1826. It's at the top.
It's, yeah, it's the 11/13/15 assessment by Dr. Denbor.
The page number is actually...
The PDF page number.
Which one, 1826?
Yeah, 1826.
1826 case.
And page, Jennifer, what page is he on the PDF?
He's actually looking at a report for 1825, so I believe we'll need to wait until we get to that.
So Dr. Gale, that's for a different case, there's four cases that we're reviewing. So you're looking at 1825, so when we deal with that case, we can, which will be later today?
Okay. And if anybody wants to ask us questions about the documents, we're not looking to the board's computer here that gives us access to them.
Okay, you should have a thumb drive or something, is it loaded or loaded on there?
There's a password.
Oh, the password. Oh, sorry about that.
Yeah, Dr. Gale, there's four separate sets of documents. I think we're... It's a similar kind of thing, and we should be able to cross them because they're there, but that's one of the issues.
Well, just let me know when I should bring this up.
Okay, well, all right, are there any other questions on case 1826? All right, hearing none, thank you for coming forward. I'm going to ask Dr. Toma to come forward.
I believe, sorry, you can ask questions.
Okay, thank you. Dr. Toma was the practice monitor for Dr. Denbor during these time periods. Dr. Denbor had a consent decree, part of that was Dr. Toma was to work with him. And so, Dr. Toma, thank you for being here today. And if you'd like to present your findings and thoughts in regards to this matter, we'll appreciate it.
Well, so I didn't have access to anything prior to, other than the board's review, prior to my starting to work with him. So I've only reviewed cases from, I think it was November of 2018 through to October 2019. So a lot of the complaints that even trickled in while I was working with him related to things we were, that had occurred before, and we were already in the process of addressing. So it's hard, I need to put that, I guess, into perspective, because I've seen a lot of different things since the actual files that were reviewed by the board or came in to the board. But I did work on the issues, and I think I addressed them in my reports to the board, on the issues that were listed in the consent agreement. The issue of billing, we started with that almost in the first couple of sessions. And I tried to just identify what the problem was. And there were billing clerk in his office issues that had been either already or was in the process of replacing the clerk who was billing for, my understanding, things that didn't occur, that were scheduled but didn't occur, or there were problems with the billing process. So we worked on, you know, revising the process. He got a new office manager who took all of that over. But I think the issue at that time, Blue Cross Blue Shield was still doing their audit. And I, at the time I finished, we had not heard back from that particular audit. I knew that they asked for X number of files, the clerk only gave them a small percentage of it. When they were found out that the clerk hadn't given them the adequate number, he provided more files. I remember that whole process occurring, but the outcome never came during the time. The issue of report writing, I agree with Dr. Lichtenberg. There's a, you know, I put much more in my reports. There's variation of what is the standard of practice and what's the minimum requirement for reports. And I don't know, know whether this is good or, you know, or bad, but I, in my practice, review records from all over the state. And there's some pretty significant differences about what people are putting in their progress notes, if they have progress notes, what they're putting in their reports, how they write their reports. I looked at what would be a minimum standard based upon what APA requires, and there were things that he changed, that I asked him to change. As, you know, again, my reports are very different from his. They're 25 pages long, everything under the sun is in them. There are different ways of approaching report writing. I've seen ABAP neuropsychologists who write very similar to him. It's a kind of a medical model. The docs are only going to spend 5 minutes on the report and they're going to zero in on the bottom line. And so if you're writing to that particular audience, there's a very different approach on how you do your reports. There were things in the report that his report writing and his informed consent in the process of how people were, you know, brought in his advertisement. We went through all of those things and he responded professionally, with enthusiasm, always from 1 week to the next, or you know, our meetings, there were changes. I could see changes. There were things, I think, habitual writing problems that took a few months for him to kind of, I guess, change. But I thought his reports met minimal standards based upon what I'm seeing is going on in the state of Arizona, in the field of neuropsychology. And I think in the field of psychology overall, it hurts me to say that there's real variation in how people write reports, their level of grammar, their knowledge of the DSM, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I won't get into that. I just made sure that what I perceived to be the minimum standards were being met in his report writing. He revised the informed consent over and over based upon feedback. He started a whole policy manual for all of the employees. We talked about, even though some of them are individually licensed, like the social workers or the OTs and PTs, that he was responsible for what they enter into the records that he is responsible for. So he adopted, I can't remember whether it was NAP or SOAP, a standard format for the report writing of all the people who were entering into the record. And I think there was a lot of disgruntled, a lot of problems with this transition with some of the other people that, and there were changes in staffing. So there were a lot of very significant things that happened over the year. I never got excuses. I did get questions. He wanted to understand certain things. And in the end, right at the very end of the year, there was this horrific stuff that was going on with the investors, and there were some illegal things that were happening, some scary things that were happening. And he, to his credit, I think he did what I would have done, and asked me on an ongoing basis, what should I do? How can I protect these patients? I'm locked out of the office. I don't have access to their records anymore. And what he did, I thought, was, you know, anyone faced with that kind of situation could do. And I think he's, in an ongoing basis, applied what I believe are the minimum standards for that kind of practice. In general, I would not have wanted to be in his shoes. I mean, he was managing this practice that was getting bigger and growing very fast, and I think it was too much for him, and I don't know why there wasn't you know, another psychologist retained or whatever. But he didn't have the experience to manage that level of a practice, and I think it grew far too quickly for him. And I can relate to that. When I was in my early licensed years, my practice grew, and then I finally put a stop to it because the stress and the requirements got overwhelming. I think this stopped itself somehow. And if he were practicing as an independent psychologist, I would refer my mother to him. I think he is knowledgeable, has a passion for what he does, and I think he's really trying to be ethical. And I'm not here to advocate for him. I'm here to tell you what I've seen over the last year. There's any questions?
And I ask you very frankly some questions. You'd send your mother there.
Yes.
My direct question, are vulnerable nursing home or facility of some type elderly patients facing any risk of abuse from the doctor or his program?
Okay, so when we started, he was doing a lot of nursing home recruitment. And so I looked over his, quote, the advertising, how he approached it, and we made some changes. So if these were vulnerable adults, the process changed completely. They were to go to the nurse's station, see if there were advocates, if there were, you know, if they had, you know, powers of attorney, or if they actually were deemed to be incapacitated, he had to get permission for them to attend. And so what was happening in this transition was that the nursing home staff were previewing and looking at who should and couldn't go or who needed family members to go. And so that whole process changed. Whether he was exploiting people before, I don't know. I don't think his program is exploitive.
So our prime job here is protect the public.
Absolutely.
We're not psychology police. We're advocates to protect the public. That's what we do. And you're saying to me, having observed this, that there was a risk prior, but you assisted him in establishing protocols that would dismiss that risk so that you were assured that potential vulnerable adults in those facilities would not be harmed. Had a less likelihood of being harmed.
Yes. What I looked at was the potential for mistreating them, misguiding them, promising things that he couldn't give or that were not real, advertisement issues, all of that we looked at the beginning.
Were the services that you saw provided or supervised individualized to meet a patient's need or following a programmatic protocol?
They were following primarily, unless they were referred for a different reason, they were following the protocol. So the majority of the patients he had that I reviewed were referred for that program, either by their physicians or, I didn't see many recruitees actually from the nursing home. I think that started to fall by the wayside time-wise, but they were referred to see if they would be benefit or eligible for his program.
You've hinted, or not hinted, you've stated very boldly, the first time that I recall hearing it from anyone in this case, that there were outside pressures. Pressures from, I think the word investors was used.
I don't know what they were, partners, investors, there were.
Whatever they were.
Yeah.
But there were outside pressures. Did those pressures get to the point of inattention to clinical work or incapacity on behalf of the doctor?
I believe that the practice was growing. And I don't think he had, because I kept saying, I think you're under pressure here. No, I don't feel
And that. You're one of his therapists, your word is monitor.
Right, and I went to the to his office, I met with his office manager, I looked at their stuff that they had on their ink boards, and I thought, oh, maybe this guy's under pressure to, you know, fund or make money or whatever. And I brought that up. I think what happened was the practice grew without him being really aware of how to manage that level of a practice. And then, like, with some help and guidance, he was starting to put it all into place. But I don't know how you get that experience. Nobody teaches you how to, you know, manage a practice. I know that Midwestern has a practice, and I used to teach and taught it. But nobody can give you this whole, when you're, until you're in the middle of it, nobody can really tell you what you're going to experience. And I've never heard of anybody experiencing what he experienced at the end with these.
Okay. I mean, just one more question. Let other people have a crack at you. I've had one expert, Gerald, neuropsychology person, review charts. I have another expert who's a practice management supervisor expert with a neuropsychology background. I'm going to make an assumption. I want you to tell me if it's accurate. That the California expert reviewed charts prior to your interventions. And if he were to review charts from that date in 18 to whatever you started, that he would come up with a different finding?
No. What I can say is I agree with his approach to evaluating for dementia and evaluating the aging population. That's not what was going on in this practice. It wasn't about evaluating and getting an accurate diagnosis of the functional deficits and all of this other stuff to inform their physician. It's a different, he's providing a different service.
So it's a really, the difference between the evaluative statements is one was being evaluated in a rehabilitative mode.
Or preventive, or not preventive, but.
And the other was a different program module protocol.
Yes, if I were working in a nursing care facility and were doing evaluations for appropriate diagnosis and treatment recommendations, that's the way he described how the record should look or how the report should look is how I would do it. This is a very different, it's a very specific and very focused kind of evaluation and process.
Okay, thank you.
Any further questions?
I'm just curious, you know, I was reading some new standards put by AP and they're talking about, you know, postdoc places and training need to use or, you know, ensure that trainees are using evidence-based substantiated treatment. What would your comments be on the treatment that has been provided since Dr. Bohansky, you know, brought up the, you know, this database where evidence-based treatment lies? What was your comment?
I think his treatment, the intervention, let's call it an intervention, rather than a treatment. I think the intervention was, as it's described in the literature, and appropriate to the program that is now developing throughout the country. Is that?
But it has the evidence or not, you're not familiar.
I think, well, you know, I'm reading articles now coming out of DC that they're able to prevent high-risk individuals for schizophrenia, prevent the onset of it by early intervention. That these, you know, youth now in their 20s and 30s did not develop schizophrenia, even though they were high risk of developing it by their both parents.
It's the first break protocols.
Yeah, and so I would have never believed that an early intervention could have such a profound effect. So I'm not going to judge this early research focus, and I'm not going to judge that it's not going to be helpful or that it doesn't have the merits that they're touting. I hope it does, you know, as I'm now 60. I think we're looking at his practice as a typical therapy practice or a typical evaluation practice, and that's not really what it is. And that was what I discovered as I was, you know, getting to know his practice. Still, there were the minimum things: informed consent, following research protocols, following, you know, recruitment and advertising and documentation and all of that, I think, we put into place, and how people are brought in and out of the program, I worked on that.
I had one more question. In terms of, you know, there's a lot of talk on regarding like individual psychotherapy and building under those codes and providing, you know, one would imagine if you're doing individual, it's, you know,
right,
one-on-one, face-to-face, or could be telehealth now, we have telehealth too. But what would your comment be on that in terms of?
So I never got to see the Blue Cross Blue Shield evaluation. Otherwise, we would have been addressing it on a direct basis. What I saw was the billing for Medicare, which I understood to be appropriate for the evaluation, and then each of the subsequent things that they were doing following the initial evaluation. I did not see and I only reviewed a few cases, that there was a problem with that aspect of the billing. What I saw was there was a problem with the process within the office, a managerial kind of thing. And that we tried to target right away.
Okay.
I was waiting to hear from the Blue Cross Blue Shield, and you know, they locked them out before we could even address that.
Yes, Ms. Smith.
Madam Chair, I'd like to suggest perhaps the board vote to go into executive session to receive some brief legal advice.
Is there a motion?
So moved.
Second. All right, and a motion second to adjourn into.
Okay. Could I also recommend that maybe I'll connect with the brief?
Yes.
Let's, well, let's reconvene and then we'll go back.
Okay. Yes, could you regular session? Is there any further questions for Dr. Thoma?
No, not hearing none.
I'd like to thank you for coming and for your being the practice monitor, for your coming to this meeting and addressing us. I know it's time out of your day, and we really do appreciate it. All right, thank you. With that, we'll go into the discussion. Is there any comments, thoughts?
I'd like to start, as there's one I'm the lead on coming up here that has some very similar themes to it, I'm guessing from listening to the question you colleagues are asking here, that you're seeing issues of concern across this practice. So what do you think about putting all these together into one package and kind of considering the themes together?
Thoughts, comments?
I think given the stuff dating and given the similarities, that makes a lot of sense to be able to move forward kind of in totality versus as broken into four separate complaints.
Anyone with any concerns? Let me ask, though, I need to ask Dr. Dunbar, Mr. Reeves, if we were to combine these four, 1825, 1826, 1902, 1904 complaints,
together in this conversation. Is that fine with you?
Is that just for today?
Yes, for today, no.
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 I had actually submitted a request to consolidate these and other complaints because of the same thought.
Okay.
And it had been rejected previously, so.
Okay, well, it would be.
It's a poor idea.
Okay, it'd be probably these four. For now. All right, so given that, so we're all agreement, you're agreeing that, Mr. Reeves?
Yes.
Okay. Then I do have, which I need to respect, is two speaker request forms. And kind of last month, I have a Lindsay McHale, is it McHale?
It's LM41902.
LM.
Did she leave?
I believe she walked out.
Okay, and next one is KC.
I believe she walked out as well.
Okay. Do you want to just stick your head out and see if they're out there, or? And I want to be disrespectful in the sense of, and if they're not here, we'll just continue.
We can talk about it.
Yeah, see, okay, is there any, but I don't want to not, just, I don't want to disregard them if they're here, if that's, we need to have the opportunity. Any, so let's go into deliberations, I don't see her coming back. Any thoughts or, yes, Ms. Smith?
I guess the point you consider whether or not there's any questions for the licensee with regard to the other three cases, and then deliberate on everything at once.
All right, thank you for guiding me. Nothing? Okay, all right, so put that aside.
If we can think about moving to an informal, a combined, with the potential of a modified consent agreement, which is partially or completely met, but needs to be amended or modified to include the others, and maybe come up with a new consent agreement, which will take care of these four together.
I think she's coming back.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yes. Then I'm going to move that we do that.
So moving that, are you proposing that we go to a formal hearing, and if we...
Yeah, informal.
Informal hearing, but in lieu of that, if a consent agreement...
Will that empower the attorneys representing us and the doctor to get together?
And again, I think we need to, if we're going to discuss them in a consolidated manner, I think the first step would be to see if there's any
questions regarding that.
Kind of, you're going to take a step back and look at the review process for all four cases combined, and then the discussion process for all four cases combined. So it's a little bit clearer, I think,
right,
with regard to the amount of, you know, the information that you're considering.
So on that note, then, I think if we look at complaint 1825, which we're going to combine, but just really briefly, Dr. Bohansky, what was the summary of that?
Well, 1825 involves a dispute over whether a case was written up as an IME, or whether it was intended as an IME, or wasn't an IME, or quite frankly, sloppiness in the report, in which the complainant suggests there's all kind of misinformation, and from factual kind of demographic stuff to perhaps not attending to actual symptomatic stuff. But much of it has the same flavor of the issues that we've seen in reports in other cases.
All right, thank you. Is there any questions from the board regards to that? We've all read the case.
Mm-hmm.
And, okay. All right, the next case in the complaint was 1902. Dr. Flowers, this was yours. If you could just provide a brief summary of that.
Well, this Well, the complainant basically was unhappy, is LM, and she came in with a complaint of a certain diagnosis and did not feel that an adequate history was taken, and also complained of inaccuracies in the report, feeling that it was done inappropriately with many errors. And it's the one that I mentioned before, where there was no clinical interview by Dr. Denbar, and he relied on the input from the neuropsych technician. And then also she complained about his advertising in a video in regards to what he does as far as his program, shaving off 5 strokes from the total score and that kind of thing. So again, a lot of really, she complained too that the session was only 2 hours and 20 minutes, and essentially felt that her complaints, her main presenting problem, was not even evaluated or no history taken. And then I also found that the report was inadequate and had errors. Those were the key things.
All right, is LM here?
Madam Chair, I believe the complainant, KC, for 1825.
KC, are you, you're here?
Yes.
All right, would you like to step forward?
Sure. Can you just put this other one on hold?
Yeah, we'll just put that one on hold. Go back to 1820 to 1825. It's the one that Dr. Mahansky just summarized.
Okay. Sounds good.
Thank you for joining us today. If you could just use your initials.
Okay.
So, KC, thanks for being here. This is regards to case 1825.
Yes.
If you'd like to provide a brief summary of your comments. Thank you.
Yes. Good afternoon. Yes, I am KC. In October 2015, I was a head injury patient. I was also working and was expected to do my job as well as I had done it before I was injured. But I could not do it. The skills I had always relied on were not there for me. Today, I know about the head injury-related conditions that had not been diagnosed or addressed at that point. Then I told my doctor I could not do my job, and I thought he had missed something. He referred me to Dr. John Denmore for a neuropsychological evaluation. I went to Dr. Denmore in good faith, trusting and respecting him. I hoped his analysis would provide answers for me, or at least point me in the right direction. When I look at his reports, I see no evidence he did any analysis or tried to find answers. His sections on the test results are full of inconsistencies. His diagnoses and recommendations are unsubstantiated. He made a number of factual errors, and he left out important information I had provided. I documented the issues in the written complaint and summarized several of them in the complaint screening committee meeting. Now I will address my history and the way it was portrayed by Dr. Denmore. In my first session, Dr. Denmore interviewed me about my history. He asked if I had a history of psychological or psychiatric issues and any depression or anxiety. I answered no to both questions. No history of psychological or psychiatric issues, no depression or anxiety. It was our only conversation about my history, and I answered clearly and accurately. Although Dr. Denwell referred to my history several times in his reports, he did not do so clearly, accurately, or consistently with what I had told him. In the first report, he wrote that I was denying a significant psychological slash psychiatric history. That is not consistent with what I had said. Later in the first report, under impressions, he speculated in bold type that I had potentially pre-existing depression and anxiety. Again, that was inconsistent with what I had said and was unsubstantiated, but not as egregious as what he wrote in the second report. In the second report, Dr. Denbor claimed that there had been a follow-up interview that revealed mood-related issues, including a pervasive history of chronic anxiety and chronic depression. That is what he wrote, and every point is untrue. There was no follow-up interview, and I did not reveal mood-related issues or depression or anxiety, past or present. But after that paragraph in the second report, Dr. Denbor related to his claim about my history as if it had been substantiated, although the opposite was true. He had no support for his claim, only a description of a conversation that had not taken place. There were other conversations that did take place in which I provided information that I believed to be important. Generally, Dr. Denbor did not include that information in any report, or he misstated it. For example, I described the challenges I was having doing my job to Dr. Denbor. We had a conversation about it in which he recommended speech and language therapy. But he did not include the conversation or his own recommendation in his report. I told him about the symptoms I was experiencing, and I was actually impacted by symptoms in his presence. But he did not include the conversation or that incident in his report. I told him how hard it was for me to work as many as 40 hours a week. But he did not include that statement in the report. Instead, he wrote that I was working 60-plus hours a week. In the second and third sessions, I told him I had not yet started speech and language therapy. But he did not include that fact in his reports. Instead, he wrote that I had been in speech and language therapy and had benefited from it. And there's more. The reports are substantially inaccurate and inconsistent. However, Dr. Denbor was a licensed neuropsychologist when he wrote the reports and supposedly had evaluated me. It was my experience that his reports were taken at face value. The reports that were taken at face value were completely unrelated to the reason I was evaluated. In them, Dr. Denbor called my history into question repeatedly, attributed to me a history I did not have, and implied I had been dishonest about it. He did no objective or competent analysis of the test results. Instead, he wrote sections that are full of inconsistencies and made diagnoses and recommendations that probably seemed valid based on the way he wrote the reports, but actually were not even substantiated by his own testing. And he misstated or omitted virtually every pertinent fact I had provided. Dr. Denbor's reports made it harder for me to get answers, and that was very unfortunate for me. Because I was right. I could not do my job, and my doctor had missed something. In fact, he had missed multiple diagnoses. It took over a year for me to be fully diagnosed, and during that time, I lost my job. So I was unemployed when I went through months of testing and treatment. I am doing as well as I am today, in spite of Dr. Denbor, not because of him. It is clear to me that his conduct was unprofessional, his conclusions were unsubstantiated, and he did not take me or my situation seriously. I am asking you to take my complaint seriously. Thank you.
Thank you. We really do appreciate you being here today. Are there any questions? Just confirm you said October 15th? October 2015?
October 2015 was when the appointment was scheduled.
Okay, yes. So that was my note. All right. We do appreciate you being here today. I have one other. Where were we? We were talking. Thank you. Is there no other questions? Great. You can take a seat. All right. Dr. Flowers, you're going to provide an overview. If you want to know the overview, or you just finished that of 1902.
I believe yes.
Okay. Yeah. All right. And then complaint 1904, just Casey's not back yet. I can't see behind the fellow.
Ellen is not back, and the complainant for 1904 is not present.
Okay. All right, if you'd like to write a brief overview, Dr. Bohannon?
Yeah, this is a multitude of different complaints from SS, who was an employee of the doctor's center of the practice, and as noted in her complaint, that Dr. Denbor's practice was either called the Arizona Dimension Center, the Mental Edge Neuropsychology, or the Smart Brain Aging Inc., and there were multiple addresses and multiple presentations and multiple folks involved, and she raised many of the issues that Dr. Toma also spoke to, that the business practices were questionable or not understandable or in some fashions services were being provided by speech pathologists and billed as therapy and on and on. So there's a series of those issues there. And it was also noted earlier that she was also working for a competitor of Dr. Denbor's, and so that there was some concern about the legitimacy of some of what was being presented. But all of the issues that she presented, we have heard essentially raised in the other complaints in terms of how practice was run and how reports were prepared and how sessions did or did not occur.
Thank you. Thank you for those summaries. So those are the four complaints that we're going to be combining together then moving forward. All right. So is there a motion or a discussion? Oh, wait. Mr. East.
Thank you. We did agree to consolidate them, but we didn't agree to waive our ability to respond to the last three.
Feel free to step forward.
We will keep it brief.
Thank you.
We only have a chance to respond.
Thank you, Mr.
Houston. I can open it up to questioning to Dr. Denbor. You've done a nice job summarizing, John. Would you mind if I just give it?
I'd just like to make some preliminary or brief points regarding each case, and then I'll sort of, I apologize, but I'll take them sort of out of order at some level. The case with LM, I think I addressed that briefly in the last discussion. I appreciate the learning experience that I had in facing such a matter, and I certainly in no way will allow a patient to, quite frankly, intimidate my staff and myself into performing an evaluation when I'm not present. I recognize that was an error in judgment, although it is considered acceptable practice by neuropsychologists if they are within a certain, within a phone call and within a certain geographic range. I have other disagreements, but I feel like we probably addressed those in other correspondence. The complaint with KC did happen when I was at employed as a consultant neuropsychologist working with concussion at Banner Concussion Center. I disagree with many of her statements. I don't feel like they're factually correct, and I would encourage the board to seek out the evidence in that respect. Nevertheless, I do feel the court could have been better. I disagree with, or I guess I would say that I've never worked with a client where I have intentionally left any data out and tried to portray anything other than the truth in the report. But were there clerical errors in the report? There were. And I've improved them substantially, and nor do I feel that that was acceptable at the time, those clerical errors, but I would humbly disagree with her perception, although I can understand it, that I was somehow working against her. I was a consultant neuropsychologist to physician, Dr. Erickson, and he felt that I responded appropriately within standard of care and admirably, and he held the same conclusions that I did in the report. So I do have various detailed areas of disagreement, but I do feel like we responded to those in previous correspondence. I think I would simply say that I don't take any individual's concerns lightly. I probably, similar to you, I got into this profession because I wanted to, and still do, want to help people. So to hear allegations that I was doing the opposite is extremely hurtful to me at a personal level. And I do take them extremely seriously.
I just want to add one thing. Three of the four complaints that have now been consolidated all stem from reports or issues which occurred prior to the practice monitor being in place. And so that's one of the things that I know is difficult for this board to consider. You had several complaints, practice monitor came in, made some changes to John's practice, has given glowing reports both in writing at the last hearing and then here today. And so I just would ask you to take that into consideration. The fourth complaint was the one that was filed by SS. It was after or during the practice monitor period. It's during. And the significance of her position was that she wrote about practices and had information that she had actually taken from Dr. Denbor's practice while she was actively working for a competitor. And there's some question whether she had legitimate access to that information. And also the nature of that complaint is such that if we're questioning the abilities and the knowledge level of text, boy, that was a sophisticated complaint. So sophisticated, in fact, I think that it probably had some drafting done by a competitive psychologist. So,
and I just might add, when that complaint came in, I reviewed that complaint immediately with Dr. Toma, and we went over that exact complaint as well as the process and procedures behind that complaint. And that complaint actually prompted Dr. Toma to do an in-person 8-hour visit to my practice, examining that exact nature of that complaint.
And that was before he wrote his final report, which reflected his analysis of the SS complaint.
All right, thank you. Just to summarize, three of the four were during the required to practice monitor.
Correct.
And the last one was the one after. Okay.
Yes.
Appreciate that. Thank you. Thanks. All right.
Since we have decided to consolidate, I'm assuming, and you know, there's definitely a lot of areas that we do need to go into deeper, I would recommend or make a motion to move this to an informal hearing.
So. And is that for the potential violations as identified in the investigative reports for each case?
Yes.
I second the motion.
Okay. And are we offering the option of
I really feel we need to do an informal hearing. You know, there is so much that needs to be looked at. I'm not ready to move to a consent agreement.
I agree. I think it's three out of four were during the prior to the consent agreement. So, all right, so we have a motion. We have a second to move to an informal hearing.
That would be an informal interview.
Interview, sorry. I'm getting used to these terms. All right. Comments? Thoughts? All right.
I agree.
Okay, so yeah.
I agree. I think I haven't read the information yet, but I think there is a pending another complaint for CSC. I wonder if I haven't looked at it.
Oh, no, we can't bring any of that.
Yeah,
that's
up.
Not.
Okay, sorry, just make a comment. Okay.
Yeah. Just to clarify, we cannot discuss any other potential complaints that are not on today's agenda.
Okay.
Yeah. All right, so we have a motion and a second to move to an informal interview. All in favor?
Aye.
Hearing any opposed?
Great.
Hearing none. All right, so this motion carries. Next item is item 10, discussion, consideration of possible action related to the possibility of opening a complaint for possible non-compliance regarding Dr. John Dunsworth's consent agreement for cases 1639, 1653, and 1723. So does the staff have any comments?
Yes, I'd like to provide a summary and an update for this matter. On October 9th of 2018, Dr. Dunbar did enter into consent agreement with the board for these three complaints, which included the following requirements. Dr. Dunbar's license is placed on probation for a minimum of 1 year from the effective date unless otherwise ordered by the board. At the end of 1 year, Dr. Dunbar may petition the board in writing and request termination from probation. In addition, prior to the end of the term of probation, Dr. Dunbar shall complete 18 hours of continuing education in the areas of record keeping, informed consent, and billing practices. While on probation, he shall work with a practice monitor, Dr. Toma, who will provide guidance and input to Dr. Dunbar in the areas of performing evaluations, informed consent, record keeping, and billing practices. If the board determines that Dr. Dunbar has not complied with the requirements of the consent agreement, the board may either continue the probation or institute proceedings for possible noncompliance. Currently, Dr. Dunbar is still under this consent agreement and on probation. In review of his compliance file yesterday, I did note that Dr. Dunbar had not submitted any certificates of completion for continuing education in regards to the 18 hours required. It has come to my attention that the office did receive a fax this morning from Dr. Dunbar at 10:45 a.m., which contains certificates of completion for several CE courses. Given that this information was submitted during the meeting, staff has not had an opportunity to review the certificates to determine if it satisfies the education requirements for the consent agreement. Staff would need ample time to check the file to ensure that these certificates were not submitted with his last renewal application or submitted for the continuing education audit. In regards to the supervision, it has already been discussed that Dr. Toma was Dr. Dunbar's practice monitor. He did submit 4 quarterly reports, with his final report being submitted in late October. In review of those reports, it appears that the supervision started in October 18 and ended in October 19. I do want to note that the consent agreement indicates that the supervision shall occur while Dr. Dunbar is on probation. He is still on probation currently, but the supervision did end approximately 3 months ago. To add to this, at the CSC meeting back in November, when the committee reviewed complaint 1904, which I believe Ms. Shreve and Dr. Bohansky were present for, we did ask Dr. Toma questions with regards to the supervision that he did provide. The committee noted that review of billing practices was one of the requirements listed in the consent agreement for supervision, but they had concerns that it may not have been fully reviewed and addressed during supervision. I believe that Dr. Toma has stepped out, so I'm not sure if he will be returning for questions, but of course Dr. Dunbar and his attorney are here, so you may wish to hear from them as well. And this concludes my summary.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I believe Dr. Toma did speak about billing and reviewing billing when he was here. So in looking at the different requirements, I guess what needs to clarify, probation was for 1 year.
The consent agreement indicates that his license shall be placed on probation for a minimum of 1 year from the effective date, unless otherwise ordered by the board. At the end of 1 year, if all stipulations are satisfied, then he can petition the board in writing, request termination. That has not occurred.
Okay, he hasn't petitioned the board. Okay.
And also, we did not receive any of the continuing education certificates until this morning.
Okay, so those need to be evaluated.
Correct.
And at this point, I don't know if we can make a recommendation or anything with it.
I would recommend we wrap it into the informal, and that at that point, that those are topics that could be discussed. This is probation.
Well, I think this is right. That's not part of the informal. That'd be a different topic on the agenda, just like it is.
I think you would need to first vote whether or not to open an investigation to determine compliance
with the consent agreement.
Correct. Well, consent agreement. Should we get
okay? But I think we need to just put this, not act on this item right now. We don't have all the information to see if he's met anything, if he's met the 18 credits, and he hasn't requested to be taken off probation. So he should still be under Dr. Toma, or as far as supervision, if that's what my understanding is.
Correct. I believe. However, Dr. Toma did submit his final report back in October, so they, it's my understanding that supervision ended at that point.
Dr. Toma testified to us that the practice was closed.
Is that, Mr. Reeves, maybe you can help with that?
The practice was closed recently, so it wasn't October. But I think that Dr. Toma did testify that he had.
Hello, there doesn't appear to be any activity in this meeting.
That makes me feel really bad. So it's, so I'm sorry, so Dr. Toma did put in a final report.
He did testify here today that he has continued to work with John and consult with John throughout the business dispute. I don't know that it's fair to say that the supervision has continued, but their relationship has continued in communication.
Okay, I'm wondering if it was clear, because when I read it, that the probation is 1 year, and that would be the, it seems, you know, the monitor.
That's the way we read it as well. He did complete the CTs, and John, this came up last night at the complaints meeting.
Okay.
And John told me at that point that he had completed, and he had submitted his CTs. One of the problems is he doesn't have access to his emails any longer either, so I can't provide you with an email today where he submitted those, so I don't think it makes much sense to dispute that.
All right.
The other thing that was mentioned the last time we met was that perhaps there was some wisdom to not terminating his probation, hence the reason we haven't moved to terminate that.
Right.
Because of, you know, ongoing.
Potentially to amend or whatnot. So instead of, my suggestion, we don't act on this, we move this to the next time we meet. Does that make a sense?
Yes.
To table the agenda.
To table, thank you, to table. Do we need a motion to do that?
Yes.
Okay.
I move to table the agenda item number 10.
All right, I got a motion. Do I have a second?
Second.
Got a second, Dr. Gill, all in favor?
Aye.
Any opposing? Hearing none. All right, we're gonna table this item. Last item on the agenda. Thank you for done with this. Any new agenda items for future meetings?
Excuse me, I'm sorry.
Yes.
Madam Chair, on the consent agenda, Dr. Bohansky had accused.
Yes, I'm sorry, that was my error.
Thank you.
I need to go back to the consent agenda. Dr. Bohansky accused on consent item C, the requesting approval for licensing by waiver, and the name is?
Rushi Patel.
Rushi Patel. So I would need a motion.
She's my postdoc. I've been supervising.
I can make a motion. I reviewed her case, and she meets the requirements for, and I do remember her, probably because of her name.
Okay. Dr. Borghansky's recusing from this vote, and is there a second?
I second the motion.
We have a motion and a second. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? All right, motion carries. Thank you, Kathy, for reminding them of that. Now, any new agenda items for future meetings? All right, hearing none, we'll go to item 20, adjournment. Is there a motion to adjourn?
So moved.
You got a motion?
A second.
A second? You got a motion and a second? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? All right, we are done. And thank you, everybody. Thank you for your participation, and great.
Moderating.